Well, welcome to the fourth lecture in our Darwin College lecture series on the theme of Darwin. Last week's speaker described the extraordinary impact of Darwin's work on the 19th century world of science, and how it was subsequently subject to continued interpretation, reinterpretation, and misinterpretation. Tonight we turn to literature. Our speaker is Rebecca Stott, Professor of Literature and Creative Writing at the University of East Anglia. Born in Cambridge, she studied for her first degree and her doctorate at the University of York before teaching for some years at here in Cambridge at Anglia Ruskin University. Many of you will know her for her splendid novel Ghost Walk, which provided lurid insights into the life of both the young Isaac Newton and also of contemporary Cambridge. You'll be aware and pleased, I'm sure, to know that her second novel, The Coral Thief, about dark dealings in 19th century French science, is due later this year. But we have Rebecca Stott tonight in her professorial mode. She's published widely on 19th century literature, and on its interface with science. And her part biography, Darwin and the Barnacle, was published to great acclaim about 5 years ago. She's currently completing a book on the migration of evolutionary ideas before Darwin. Rebecca Stott is uniquely well qualified to talk to us about Darwin and in the literary world. It's a pleasure to introduce her.
My mic's working. Does that sound all right? Can you hear me at the back? Good. Well, first of all, of course, thank you very much to the Darwin Lecture Series organisers for inviting me. It's a great privilege to be here and to have such a wonderful audience. And thank you so much for turning out in the snow. It really is horrible out there, so much appreciated. Secondly, I'd just like to dedicate this lecture to Dame Professor Gillian Beer, who is in Yale, unfortunately, and can't be here today, because, of course, she's the pioneer in this field of studying literature in relation to Darwin's influence on literature. So I dedicate it to her as the most important pioneer in the field. Okay. I grew up in an austere creationist fundamentalist household. As members of the Brethren, my family attended one-hour prayer meetings most days of the week and three times on Sundays. As a girl child, I wore a headscarf to school knotted at the back of my neck. We looked rather like Amish children or Amish children, somewhat anachronistic in the streets of Brighton in the 1960s. I went to an ordinary primary school, but I was discouraged from making friends with the other children, and there were many lessons that I wasn't allowed to attend. So like the delightful child in the recent film Son of Rambo, I spent a great deal of time reading in school corridors. Because there were so many lessons I wasn't allowed to attend, I grew to love the smell and silence of school corridors. And, of course, I spent a lot of time in the school library, where I found books that were forbidden at home, books by Blyton, by Nesbitt, and collections of Norse and Russian folk tales. I wasn't allowed to bring these books home, so I learned to speed read very quickly. It was a great skill to learn at a young age. There were books at home, but they were mostly religious books and sets, long sets of ministries. There was also a set of Encyclopedia Britannica, which for me, a very bookish child, was a kind of heaven. Every now and again, one of the ministering brothers would mention Darwin. Darwin was always referred to as the mouthpiece of Satan. Like television sets, like radios, like films, like rock and roll, and newspapers. Above all the things to remember about Darwin was that he'd been sent to Earth by Satan to lead men away from God. He was not just a bad man, he was a really bad man. Darwin, we were told, wanted to keep us on the wrong side of the line at Judgment Day. So one day, alone in the house, curious about what Satan's mouthpiece might look like, I went to look him up in the family encyclopedia, only to find that the page where Darwin would have been was missing. The page was just not there. There was no torn edge. It had clearly been cut out. Years later, I ventured to ask my father about this when we'd left the Brethren, and my father had actually become very outspoken against the Brethren. And I asked him about the missing page, and he told me that he remembered as a small child being the day that the encyclopedia arrived, which my grandfather, a very austere man, had ordered in a liberal moment. On that day, my grandfather had taken all the volumes out of this box, one by one, and in front of the three children, and had sent my grandmother to fetch a razor. "We will not have Satan in this house," he said, as he cut out the Darwin page. Once the page was out and burned on the open fire, my grandmother was allowed to place the volumes of the encyclopedia on the shelf. So I start with that, because I still can't think about Darwin without remembering the razored out page, and perhaps even more acutely, the intense curiosity that missing page created. And of course, such censorship, as the theorist Michel Foucault has argued, only works to incite transgression. I found another set of encyclopedias in the school library. What I read there about Darwin and his ideas at about the age of 8 or 9 was extraordinary, totally beyond my comprehension, an absolutely different narrative from the one I had been told about how the world had come to be. It tangled with my otherwise Manichaean sense of the world. The picture of the old man with the white beard stayed in my head for a long time. He looked interesting and avuncular to me, ordinary, kindly, not at all satanic. Ever since, for one reason or another, my own attempts to understand metaphysical questions have been tangled up with trying to understand Darwin and what his ideas mean, and I mean really mean, in the widest sense. Whether I will it or not, what I write in fiction or non-fiction seems to be an ongoing dialogue between two ways of seeing: the Christian fundamentalist way of seeing that I was raised within, and I mean by that straight lines, fixity, binaries, blacks and whites, and Darwinian as an alternative way of seeing the world, fecund, mutating, metamorphic, on the move, non-teleological. I wrote a book about Darwin in 2003, and soon afterwards I had a letter from some brethren who knew me saying they were praying for me. My first novel, Ghost Walk, turns on the idea of entanglement and historical contingency. My new novel, The Coral Thief, is an evolutionary love story about transformation set in Paris in 1815. Darwin keeps coming back, not surprisingly, perhaps, given the page. So in looking at that kaleidoscope of dazzling shapes that represents Darwinism, novelists and poets have, from different generations, have seen different things, have found different shapes, have found different answers to the questions that pressed upon them. And sometimes those answers are beautiful, grand, benign, or enchanting, and sometimes they're nightmares of oblivion, destruction, and warfare. The most interesting narratives in poetry are often both of those things simultaneously. Why does it matter for us to think about Darwin in the literary world? Why go there? And I would say that there are several reasons for doing it, because it tells us, looking at Darwin's influence on literature, shows us the extraordinary diversity of philosophical and literary responses to Darwin. Different generations have had different responses. It shows us that texts, even scientific texts like On the Origin of Species, are like kaleidoscopes. Different people see different things. They do not stay still. It also shows us how Darwinism was assimilated. Novelists and poets who use Darwinian ideas are not just disseminators. They are translators. They are interpreters. They don't just replicate ideas. They transform them. They show us how ideas can be adapted for new ways of seeing or understanding. And finally, because looking at how Darwin influenced literature reminds us that the way that we see the world and our own relation to it is always mediated by stories. Before I look at a number of encounters between Darwin and literature, I just want to think for a moment about Darwin as a reader as well as a writer. What kind of reader was he? What did he read? He tells us himself that he read Horace's odes at school, and that Horace's odes were the only poetry he could keep in his head for more than a day before it disappeared. He couldn't memorize anything else. He read Wordsworth, he read Coleridge, he read Byron and Shakespeare. He read Shakespeare in the window seat of his school, he said. He read Austen, Jane Austen, on the Beagle. He and Fitzroy discovered they had a shared love of Jane Austen. And it's tempting to think of the two of them arguing about Emma or Mr. Darcy whilst the Beagle sailed through darkened seas. And, of course, most importantly, he read Milton on the Beagle. And Julian Beer has written a fascinating essay on the influence of Milton on Darwin. And she points out that Darwin received or gained a sense of the fecundity of nature from reading Milton, and also the complex interdependence of good and evil. And later, well, Darwin kept a reading notebook. It really is. Working on Darwin is so delightful because there's so much left. The letters in the importance in the correspondence project, but the notebooks, endless notebooks about his health, about what he read, and so on, his children. And he kept a notebook of everything that he read year by year with a little score next to it, which said something like poor or average or good or very good. So we got a fairly good sense of what Darwin read and what he thought about what he read as well. As he got older, his literary tastes changed, and he deeply regretted this. Sorry, this is a list of all the writers and poets who have been connected with Darwin or who are seen as having been influenced in one way or another by Darwinian ideas, either because they tell us that they were, that they read Darwin and we have records of their responses to Darwin, or because we have a fairly good idea that they read Darwin and literary critics have been able to show a very significant Darwinian pattern in their novels or poetry. So we know that, I'm going to come to this in a moment, he described himself in his autobiography as having changed his literary tastes as he got older. He describes himself as having, in the last 20 or 30 years, he says up to the age of 30 or beyond it, poetry of many kinds, such as the works of Milton, Gray, Byron, Wordsworth, Coleridge, and Shelley, gave me great pleasure. And even as a schoolboy, I took intense delight in Shakespeare, especially in the historical plays. But now, for many years, he says, I cannot endure to read a line of poetry. I have tried lately to read Shakespeare and found it so intolerably dull that it nauseated me. This is strong words for Darwin. I have almost lost any taste for pictures or music. On the other hand, novels, he says, which are works of the imagination, though not of a very high order, have been for years a wonderful relief and pleasure to me, and I often bless all novelists. A surprising number have been read aloud to me, by Emma, of course, and I like all, if moderately good, and if they do not end unhappily. Against which, he says, a law ought to be passed. A novel, according to my taste, does not come into the first class unless it contains some person whom one can thoroughly love. And if it be a pretty woman, all the better. So I sometimes wonder what Darwin would have made of the fact that so much literature since his day is shot through, like shot silk, with Darwinian ideas. It would certainly, he would certainly have been saddened by the fact that very few profoundly Darwinian novels have happy endings. The logic of the Darwinian story does not allow easily for happy endings. It doesn't really allow for an ending at all. What would Darwin, for instance, have made of Tess, Hardy's Tess, published, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, published a few years after his death in 1891? She's certainly a pretty girl. She's a very pretty girl. But that's precisely why Hardy insists she can't have a happy ending. She's hounded by the forces of natural and sexual selection, punished for her own sexual desires, punished because she is desired, punished because chance seems to turn against her at every corner, and she struggles to survive, moving relentlessly towards that final sacrifice, her last night spent sleeping on the stones of Stonehenge before she is taken away to be tried and hanged. Would Darwin have passed a law against such a book, against such a way of seeing? He might have. In this novel, Hardy refers to the ache of modernism. That ache of modernism is in part a Darwinian ache. So these are, as I said, that list which I showed you before, are some of the people who have been influenced. I could go on adding to this list, and I added a couple more just this morning. Angela Carter, who in an interview in 1984, in Marxism Today, of all places, declared herself a Darwinian and went on to explain how. But yes, so this is a fairly long list, but it could be longer. Okay, in August 1859, Darwin ordered 80 presentation copies of On the Origin of Species to send out to men in Britain and Europe who, in his view, would influence its reception. This list included men of science, geologists, churchmen, historians, and medical men, but it only included one novelist. In November 1859, the postman delivered a carefully wrapped presentation copy of On the Origin of Species to this quiet rectory in Elversley in Hampshire. 4 days before the book went on sale, the rector, who was also a keen biologist, wrote the following letter to its author. "Dear sir, I have to thank you for the unexpected honour of your book, that the naturalist whom of all naturalists living I most wish to know and to learn from should have sent a scientist like me his book, encourages me at least to observe more carefully and think more slowly. I am so poorly in brain that I fear I cannot read your book just now as I ought. All I have seen of it awes me, both with the heap of facts and the prestige of your name, and also with the clear intuition that if you be right, I must give up much that I have believed and written." The rector then goes on to tell Darwin two things. One, that he has long given up the dogma of the permanence of species as a biologist. And secondly, that he's absolutely sure that God made all the first forms with an ability to evolve into all forms needful. The letter was signed Charles Kingsley. And 3 years later, Charles Kingsley began to write a book most of you will know, published as The Water Babies in 1863. You will remember, if you read it as a child, Tom, the chimney sweep on the run from his master, who falls into a river and with the help of some fairies turns into a water baby. And the prose is delightful and playful and absolutely revels in the possibilities of what Tom can change into underneath the water. Tom undergoes a series of metamorphoses and learns some important moral lessons until he emerges finally as an English gentleman and marries the pretty girl. Yes, so there is a happy ending. The story is a coming-of-age narrative, like most Victorian novels, if you think about Oliver Twist, Great Expectations, Jane Eyre. But it's the only coming-of-age story that I know of in the 19th century set almost entirely underwater. Not surprisingly, perhaps. In the middle of this underwater journey, Tom finds the sea mother at the end of the world, who is making endless forms. She sends them out into the world to make themselves. So Kingsley brilliantly turned Darwinian evolution into a narrative of self-improvement and redemption. Kingsley's charming novel has been read every which way, but the important things I would draw attention to here is the novel really celebrates human-animal kinship. It's not disturbed by it, and you'll see in a little while that he's unusual in that respect. Secondly, the human boy shrinks until he's smaller than all the other creatures that he comes across. And that shrinking's really important. It's a pattern that's repeated all the way through the 19th century. And that the transmutations are aquatic. Critics who've looked at the influence of Darwin on 19th century literature in particular have really made a big deal of the ape and the primates as the evolutionary icon, if you like, which best embodies Darwinian fears or fears of Darwinian ideas. And in fact, I would say from the studies that I've done that aquatic creatures are just as prevalent and perhaps more dominant than the ape as a evolutionary icon. And finally, I'd say that what Kingsley does in his novel is to give us this delightful fairy tale, the little boy who changes and who's given an opportunity to learn all these things and then to come out of the water as an English gentleman. But behind all the talking animals and the mutating forms and the comedy, we are reminded constantly of the cruelties in the struggle for existence. Kingsley won't let us forget that. He won't let us look away. He does give us, though, a happy ending. What would Darwin have made of the water babies? I think he'd have been slightly embarrassed by it, I think. Although no doubt also delighted by, or perhaps just amused by the fact that Kingsley had appropriated his ideas for moral and quasi-mystical ends. Now, in the early 1860s, about the same time that Kingsley was writing The Water Babies, Charles Dodgson, Oxford don and mathematician, who had no doubt grown pretty tired of high-table conversation about Darwin, which, living in Oxford, he would have heard a lot of, in 1862 he went rowing on the Thames with the three little girls, daughters of the Dean of Christchurch, and he told the girls a story about a girl falling down a rabbit hole. In 1864, he wrote it all out by hand, as Alice's Adventures Underground. And in 1865, he published it as Alice in Wonderland. So this is Dodgson's original handwritten manuscript of Alice's Adventures Underground, 1864. It's a beautiful thing. And this is one of his own drawings, which people don't, you probably haven't seen before. This is, of course, the Pool of Tears, where Alice falls into cries as a very tall person and then shrinks and falls into her own pool of tears, salt water, and all the other animals fall in there too. And I think this image is really, really interesting in terms of Alice, again, has shrunk in size, she's gone into the water, and there she is, all mixed up with these other animals, feathered, furred, and there's also a dodo in there as well, which, of course, was Dodgson's nickname. He was called the dodo. So Alice, like Tom, falls into a strange underground world which operates according to chaotic rules, but which is also full of mutating and expanding and contracting animal and human body parts. Alice's body stretches, contracts, and elongates in an underground world of eat and be eat or be eaten, in which an endless variety of hybrid and grotesque animals, this is, of course, Tenniel's beautiful drawing of the dodo, and this is Dodgson's original drawings of the mock turtle and the griffin and the lobster quadrille. I'll come back to him in a minute. So the novel is, of course, a thought experiment, which is much more than the Darwinian content in it. Dodgson was a philosopher and a logician, and the novel is full of philosophical questions. The caterpillar, at the center of this book, the caterpillar asks Alice, "Who are you?" And this, I think, is the driving question, if you like, of the first generation of novelists who were responding to Darwinian ideas. Not necessarily always theological, much more ontological. What is man? Where does he begin? Where does he end? And how is he different from the animals? Now, I'm going to show you some pictures you won't have seen, and these are really rather shocking. I find them so, and I've looked at them a lot. In September 1861, 2 years after Darwin published On the Origin. This 55-year-old marine painter was very well known, did wonderful big paintings of ships. He was also a geologist. He's called Edward Cook. He went to the British Association for the Advancement of Science meeting in Manchester. It was the largest of the 75 annual gatherings which the association had held. There were over 3,000 people there. They'd come for more Darwin dramas, I'm sure, the Darwin wrangles. For a week, Cook dined late after sessions with fellow delegates, including his friend, the zoologist Richard Owen, who was, of course, sounding off about Darwin's new book and its implications. So those conversations that Cook participated in were all about the implications of Darwin's ideas. A few days later, exhausted and thinking through these ideas, he travelled to a seaside inn at Blue Anchor in Somerset in order to do a few days sketching, resting. He wanted to draw fossils in particular. This bit of the coast is really good for collecting fossils, and he wanted to draw fossils. He found he was the only guest at the inn, and as he began sketching, he found himself drawing not fossils, but a series of cartoon-like creatures. Now, I'm going to show you these pictures now. Nothing in my lecture gets worse than this, I warn you, in terms of the images. I could show you many. There are 100 in total. Over the next few days, he drew more than 100 hybrid monstrous creatures, grotesque and curious combinations of bones, shell, feathers, tusks, scales, and human limbs. He called them his Darwin animals. 8 years later, he published them in a book aimed at the Christmas market. The book did not do well in the Christmas market. And each plate had a Latin motto pointing a moral. On the title page, he inscribed the lines, "These oddities from fancy drawn may surely raise the question, will Darwin say by chance they're formed or natural selection?" The rhyme doesn't quite work there. The images, of course, don't come out of a cultural vacuum. Let's have a look at another one. Aren't these amazing? Notice that most of these settings are shoreline settings. There are some exceptions, but the majority of settings are shoreline. I'll come back to that in a moment. These images don't come out of a cultural vacuum. Cook had clearly seen medieval bestiaries and the animal grotesques of Hieronymus Bosch and Bruegel. And he was certainly familiar with the animal-human grotesques of the French social satirist Granville. But there is something completely new here, don't you think? The idea of human transmutation from simple animal forms had transformed in Cook's mind into something deeply uncanny and newly monstrous. Notice again, I'm trying to make connections here. Obviously, they're such a long way from Kingsley and Cook, but I do think they have things in common. Notice again the scale, the human. I mean, these creatures are supposed to be primarily human, but they're made up of different bits of other animals. The scale is diminished, although the human form is retained. Once again, notice the dominance of the aquatic and the shoreline. Even when the creatures are made up of reptile parts or primate parts, they are still set on these shorelines over and over again. And notice also, as in Kingsley and Carroll, what I would call the chiaroscuro of Darwinism, the shadowing of the comic and the uncanny and the grotesque, all mixed in together. So I offer you these three. I could give you several more, but I don't have time. This is the first generation response. Cook and Carroll and Kingsley all produce hybrid animals, very, very different in their type. They're largely aquatic, or at least they're situated in a shoreline or on a water's edge. And these fantasized animals do not raise theological questions, or not obviously theological questions. They raise ontological ones. They ask the caterpillar question, who are you? They also ask, what is a man? Where does man begin? What is man's place in nature? And also, what might we become? By the end of the 19th century, a new pattern of literary response starts to emerge. It's related, but it's darker. The monsters are imagined, the monsters that were imagined and invented in the 1860s in response to Darwinism get larger and threaten invasion. In Robert Louis Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde, for instance, Jekyll unleashes a beast inside himself, small, stunted, and horrifying. My devil had long been caged. He came out roaring, we're told. In Bram Stoker's Dracula, the vampire... Sorry, I should have shown you that a minute ago. In Bram Stoker's Dracula, the vampire is an invading degenerate who can shapeshift, turning himself into a bat, rats, a dog, a lizard, and wolves. He can cross the boundaries of time and of species. By this point in literary history, the fear of degeneration is uppermost in these stories, as it is in... the fear of degeneration is uppermost in these stories, as it is in other cultural anxieties of the period. The fear that if human species can progress, that a reverse narrative might also be possible. These narratives enact a series of expulsions. Dracula must be driven out. The Martians must be driven out. Hyde must be driven out. Man is dethroned, and this is H.G. Wells' term, which I'll come to in a moment. He described an acute sense of dethronement in The Time Machine. So we're getting here a shift towards a certain kind of science fiction. It's not the beginnings of science fiction, because really that has its origins in Frankenstein, and perhaps even earlier, but a new kind of science fiction, and certainly horror writing. H.G. Wells, trained as a zoologist at the Normal School of Science in South Kensington, under Huxley, T.H. Huxley, and he knew Darwin's work well. He had first-class honours in zoology and second-class honours in geology. When he came to writing War of the Worlds in 1897, this was about 7 years after he'd graduated, a novel in which Martians invade the Earth and start to bring down all of its webs and networks. The first thing the Martians do in order to gain control is take out the railway system. Brilliant. So the narrator describes an intense feeling of oppression and horror. He says, "I felt the first inkling of a thing that presently grew quite clear in my mind, that oppressed me for many days, a sense of dethronement, a persuasion that I was no longer a master, but an animal among the animals, under the Martian heel." Wells's Martians are like outsized, mechanized octopuses with legs. Except for the ape-like Morlocks in The Time Machine, Wells's monsters are more often creatures of slime and tentacles rather than of fur and feathers. As I've said, critics have tended to overemphasize the place of the primate and the ape as the evolutionary icon. Perhaps the fear of being kin to sea creatures, things with tentacles, is more visceral. It produces a different kind of uncanny. Wells describes the feeling of nausea in the presence of these monsters many times in his work. And in H.G. Wells's earlier story, The Time Machine, the time traveler reaches the desolate shore of the end of the world. He sees the very last living creature in it. These two are shore creatures. The much-feared ancestor for Wells is a sea creature, not an ape, a creature of an older origin and a more terrifying time. This is how he imagines man, 30 million AD. A horror of this great darkness came on me. Note the horror and the nausea. The cold that smote to my marrow and the pain I felt in breathing overcame me. I shivered and a deadly nausea seized me. Then, like a red-hot bow in the sky, appeared the edge of the sun. I got off the machine to recover myself. I felt giddy and incapable of facing the return journey. As I stood, sick and confused, I saw again the moving thing upon the shoal. There was no mistake now that it was moving. It was a moving thing against the red water of the sea. It was a round thing, the size of a football, perhaps, or it may be bigger, and tentacles trailed down from it. It seemed black against the weltering blood-red water, and it was hopping fitfully about. Then I felt I was fainting, but a terrible dread of lying helpless in that remote and awful twilight sustained me while I clambered upon the saddle. Wells's work is in many ways an expression of a generation overwhelmed by a sense of dethronement. Britain was, of course, no longer holding its place in the world unchallenged. The period from 1870 to 1914 in Britain was a period of prolific invasion literature, a sign precisely of this sense of dethronement, not only of species, but of a nation and an empire. And by the early 20th century, once we've skirted past World War I and World War II, there's a marked shift, interestingly, away from these horrible monsters towards a greater acceptance of the destructive and conflictual relationships at the heart of the natural world and of the animal-human kinship. The advent of Freud and of Marx and of the Holocaust, an acceptance of the dark forces of work, I think, at work within nature and within man. When you read D.H. Lawrence or Ted Hughes or Tom Gunn or Dylan Thomas, you can see that the argument for man's essentially bestial animal nature had been won. And what would Darwin have made of all of this? What would he have made of Wells and Lawrence and Hardy? Remember, this is a man who likes happy endings and pretty heroines. Would he have owned this way of seeing, this bleak refusal of happy endings, these tentacled nightmares of invasion and dethronement? Almost certainly not. Yet the horror of famine and struggle and competition are there at the heart of Darwin's own writing. When Darwin strains his prose to new heights in order to persuade us to see something new, when he reaches towards a kind of sublime, as he does, it is to try to convince us not of the beauty of the world, but of the entanglement of terror and beauty. Remember that famous Entangled Bank passage, which I'm now going to read. It is interesting, he says, to contemplate an entangled bank, clothed with many plants of many kinds, with birds singing on the bushes, with various insects flitting about, and with worms crawling through the damp earth. And to reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other and dependent on each other in so complex a manner, have all been produced by laws acting around us. Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of the higher animals, directly follows. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers, having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that, whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. Beautiful piece of writing. Note, of course, how he stresses that the most exalted objects have emerged from famine and death. And that lovely patterned cadence of that last phrase, have been, comma, and are being, comma, evolved. Have been and are being evolved. There's a second passage in Origin that fascinates me. There's a poetry in its rhythms and in its repetitions, just as there is in the Entangled Bank. Again, Darwin insists, perhaps always remembering the horror of Annie's death that erupted into the calm serenity of the Darwin household, that we must see the entanglement of beauty and destruction together. I love this passage. Okay, I'll just read it. I've picked out the phrases that I want you to note. We behold the face of nature bright with gladness. We often see superabundance of food. We do not see, or we forget, that the birds which are idly singing around us mostly live on insects or seeds and are thus constantly destroying life. Or we forget how largely these songsters or their eggs or their nestlings are destroyed by birds and beasts of prey. We do not always bear in mind that though food may be now superabundant, it is not so at all seasons of each recurring year. We behold, but we do not see, or we forget, we do not always bear in mind. It is not so at all seasons. This is elegiac. It's mournful. It's clouded with sadness, with a dark knowing. Even in the midst of summer, he reminds us, amidst the brightness and the abundance, we do not see, or we choose to forget. We forget that repetition. And then there is that beautiful echoing phrase, we do not always bear in mind. We do not always bear. We cannot always bear. And there's the nub. There's a line very like it in George Eliot's Middlemarch, where Eliot ponders the question of how much we can bear to see or hear when she describes the misery of Dorothea Brooke's early married life to the dreadful Casaubon. That element of tragedy, which lies in the very fact of frequency, has not yet wrought itself into the coarse emotion of mankind. And perhaps our frames could hardly bear much of it. If we had a keen vision and feeling of all ordinary human life, it would be like hearing the grass grow and the squirrel's heartbeat, and we should die of that roar which lies on the other side of silence. As it is, the quickest of us walk about well wadded with stupidity. Isn't she brilliant? And it is this shadowing of the enchantment by horror or darkness that Darwin would have owned, I think. That balancing of delight and terror that begins in the beautifully tangled sentences of Origin. It's what I've called the chiaroscuro of Darwinism. He wanted us to see it and not to forget. So not all of the first generation of novelists who read Origin saw animal-human mutations or monsters. George Eliot saw webs, as Gillian Beer has described so brilliantly in her book, Darwin's Plots. George Eliot saw webs before she read Darwin. Eliot was interested in the webs of human interconnections. In the 19th century, of course, it was Thomas Hardy and George Eliot whose fiction, complex and entangled, reveals something of the knowledge that the origin of species shares, that society itself is a great entangled bank, a web of affinities, and that everyone, to use Darwin's phrase, is netted together. A change in one place means a change in another. George Eliot didn't get her sense of the web of affinities from Darwin, but from her own observations of her neighbours. And if we just, I'm just going to read the bottom bit there. We belated historians, she says in Middlemarch, must not linger over his example, and she means Fielding. I, at least, have so much to do in unravelling certain human lots and seeing how they are woven and interwoven, that all the light I can command must be concentrated on this particular web and not dispersed over that tempting range of relevancies called the universe. And of course, this sense of complex entanglement is evident in the work of many contemporary novelists too, in A.S. Byatt's beautifully entangled plot of Possession, which is shot through with references to Darwin and to entangled banks. Byatt shows us that past and present cannot be separated out. The business of the novel, she tells us, is to remind us of the relations between the living and the dead, past and present. Possession celebrates shape-shifting, continual change, flux, and entanglement. It is a reflection of the benign version of the entangled bank. Nature is plentiful, interconnected, full of interest and sublime. It is a novel with a happy ending. I think Darwin would have liked this one. And then there is also Saturday, which is also a novel shot through with Darwinian references, mostly, interestingly, missed by the reviewers of the novel, who were very mixed in their responses to Saturday. Ian McEwan's work as a short story writer and as a novelist has been a continual dialogue with Darwin and Darwinian webs. The whole novel of Saturday is a tangled bank. It encompasses a single day in the life of a successful neuroscientist, Henri Perrone. The book opens with Perrone waking from his marital bed in the middle of the night, his head full of Darwinian echoes. He'd fallen asleep in the bath the night before, reading a biography of Darwin. And so the phrase, there is grandeur in this view of things, has been going round and round in his head. So he wakes at the beginning of Saturday with that phrase in his head and goes to the window and sees a plane on fire making an arc across the night sky. And the day, which, because the whole of the novel just covers a single day, which I think is remarkable, and is, of course, a sort of homage to Virginia Woolf as well. The day is shadowed by the threat of violence. Perón has a squash match. He goes to the fish shop to buy fish to make soup in the evening, and so on. And everything is done in incredible detail, and we follow Perón through his day. But the whole of that day, that very ordinary day, is shadowed by violence, by a television set usually on a corner somewhere that tells us about the plane and how it landed, tells us about big marches in the middle of London against the Iraq War, tells us about various other acts of terrorism that are happening. And as the day opens up, Perón sees webs everywhere, in the neural pathways of the brain, in which he works on, in the tangled roads of great cities. He lacks the lyric gift of his daughter, Daisy. She is an accomplished and published poet, and it's Daisy who gives her father books to read, including a biography of Darwin. She thinks reading Darwin will help expand her father's understanding, his vision of interconnectedness. And in the early evening of this particular Saturday, the comfort and beauty of Perón's home is severed by the eruption of a violent and simian-featured boy called Baxter and his gang, who break into his house and threaten to kill his wife and rape his pregnant daughter. And in a bizarre scene, Daisy, the poet, bravely diffuses the violence by reading a poem when the invaders taunt her to do so. And the poem she chooses to read or to recite, because she's memorized it, is Matthew Arnold's Dover Beach, which McEwan is really interested in and keeps coming back. I think Dover Beach is very much on Chesil Beach as well. In the recitation of this poem, the tangled bank is complete. The boy, who has echoes of both Frankenstein's monster and Jekyll's Hyde, is overcome in both senses of the word. Order is restored. In the final pages of the book, as Perón operates on the damaged brain of Baxter, he marvels at the complexity of what he can see inside Baxter's head. And Darwin's phrase comes back again: there is grandeur in this view of life. Evolution is, McEwan tells us, a vision of grandeur, but it is also one that is driven by a phrase of his, the blind furies of random mutation. Finally, this is the very last section of my talk, poets have recognized Darwin. Poets have seen the poet in Darwin. They've recognized him in the way he moves through the commonplace, the ordinary, the overlooked, to the sublime. In 1964, my very favorite poet, Elizabeth Bishop, in 1964, Anne Stevenson wrote to the American poet Elizabeth Bishop about surrealism. She was writing a book about Bishop, and she wanted to make a connection between Bishop's poetry and surrealism. And Bishop replied. She said, "No, I'm not like the surrealists. I'm like Darwin." And this is the extract from the letter. It's actually a really interesting letter in full, but this is the important part. "Reading Darwin," Bishop says, "one admires the beautiful and solid case being built up out of his endless heroic observations, almost unconscious or automatic. And then comes a sudden relaxation, a forgetful phrase, and one feels the strangeness of his undertaking, sees the lonely young man, his eyes fixed on facts and minute details, sinking or sliding giddily off into the unknown." What Elizabeth Bishop recognized in Darwin in that letter and before in her reading of Darwin is what I would call the poetics of the commonplace. It's tempting to try to collapse time and imagine the two of them in conversation, Darwin complaining that he'd lost his feel for poetry, that he had become a mere grinder of facts. Bishop, I think, might have told him, if we can put the two of them together, that the grinding of facts is where poetry begins. She might have told him that the sublime must be reached through the commonplace, through the infinitely slow accretion of facts. "Look what you do," she might have said. "Look at the way in which you make us slide or sink with you through the solid, reliable facts, giddily off into the unknown." George Levine reminds us that there are 29 variations of the word beauty in On the Origin of Species. There are 42 uses of the word wonderful, 15 uses of the word marvelous, and 57 unknowns. I'm going to finish then with Darwin the poet. Sometime in the 1860s, Darwin startlingly told his son that he might write a poem about Drosera, the sundew, on which he was working in preparation for his book on insectivorous plants. The sundew is called the sundew because of the droplets of sticky, these sticky droplets that it produces to catch insects and which make it look like dewdrops. I'll show you a picture of it in a minute. It's a tiny and beautiful carnivorous plant. There are 170 different species. It grows on all continents except Antarctica. Darwin found a Drosera in 1860 and he brought it home to do experiments on it. It fascinated him. It made him want to write poetry. So unless there's a piece of paper still unearthed by the people in the Darwin Online Project or the Darwin Correspondence Project, as far as we know, Darwin did not write the poem about the sundew. But a wonderful poet called Amy Clampett did, 100 years later, in 1978. She published a poem called, I don't think she knew that Darwin wanted to write a poem about the sundew. She published a poem called The Sun Underfoot Amongst Sundews in The New Yorker. She's an amazing poet and a fairly new discovery for me. It was her first published poem, the poem that I'm going to read you in a moment to finish on. She was 58. She'd worked as an editor and a librarian and as a secretary all her life and had come back to writing poetry in her late 40s. And she published this first poem in The New Yorker when she was 58 and then went on to write five more collections of poems before she died in 1994. Her poems, Amy Clampett's poems, are woven through with the Darwinian sublime. In this extraordinary poem, she takes us into a Darwinian entangled bank, here imagined not as a hedgerow, but as a bank of sundews on the edge of a bog under tamarind trees. I think this is one of the most profound literary responses to Darwin I've yet read. In the poem, Clampett reminds us that we will be swallowed up, that we will not get out of here, that there is nothing beyond this bog, this life, that it is full of light and shade and complex sensuous entanglements, and it has many wet-footed understories. She takes us, it's a short poem, I'm going to read it and then finish. She takes us into the unknown. We sink, we slide. And there is so much to see, she says, so much light. We may never get out of this bog that we're in, but there's so much to see, so much light, so much of the sublime. If we look properly, she reminds us, we will begin to fall upwards. So there's another close-up of the sundew. It's such a beautiful thing, so small. Okay, I'm just going to read this poem. An ingenuity too astonishing to be quite fortuitous is this bog full of sundews, sphagnum lines, and shaped like a teacup. A step down and you're into it. A wilderness swallows you up, ankle, then knee, then midriff to shoulder, deep in wet-footed understory, an overhead spruce tamarack horizon hinting you'll never get out of here. But the sun among the sundews down there is so bright, an underfoot webwork of carnivorous rubies, a star swarm thick as the gnats they're set to catch, delectable double-faced cockle burrs, each hair tip a sticky mirror afire with sunlight, a million of them and again a million, each mirror a trap set to unhand believing that either a first cause said once, let there be sundews, and there were, or they've made their way here unaided, other than by that backhand, roundabout refusal to assume responsibility known as natural selection. But the sun underfoot is so dazzling down there among the sundews. There is so much light in that cup that looking, you start to fall upward. Thank you.
Well, since John Milton made Satan his hero, I don't suppose Charles Darwin would have minded too much being called the mouthpiece of Satan. I think it's not surprising that Darwin's theory should have shaken science, but Professor Stott's demonstration of how much he also shook the world of literature and the images which so shape our culture is, I think, a profound tribute to the extent to which he shaped and moved the furniture of our minds. I was particularly grateful to Professor Stott for drawing our attention to the beauty of Darwin's fine, balanced prose. You've given us a wonderful, very personal account. All I can say in conclusion is that it is the antithesis of being well padded with stupidity. Thank you very much.